Ryan Salam, hello, how are you?
Hi, Glenn Lowry. It's a great pleasure to be here with you and to meet you electronically. I'm a great admirer of your work and thinking, and so I very much look forward to this conversation.
Oh, thanks, Ryan. I also look forward to the conversation. I thought that we had met once before at a Cato-sponsored dinner in Washington, D.C., where Stephen Tellis, I think he's a mutual friend of ours.
No, indeed. And you collaborated with Steve Tellis, I believe, on a book on ethnicity and social mobility, if I recall correctly.
That's right. Steve and I and Tariq Modood, who's a political sociologist in the University of Bristol in the U.K., put out, you know, we got a group together and collected the papers and put out that volume. That's right. We did do that. But okay, and
a very expensive volume, but worthwhile.
Well, since I work in a university, and since we've got all these rents that are sloshing around in here from the high tuition rates that we charge, that book cost me nothing to get access to. But anyway, so I'm really glad to be talking with you. And I thought that our agenda might be to explore some of these issues about the financing of higher education and the debate that's been engendered by the policies of the Obama administration and trying to revise federal support for higher education, and by some of the comments on the campaign trail, Rick Santorum in particular, accusing the president of being an elitist because of his focus on increasing access to college and all of this kind of stuff. And I know you've been thinking and writing about that, and so I thought that might be one of the things that we talk about, and maybe we could start with that. And then I thought the other thing that we might talk about is the debate that has unfolded around the propriety, effectiveness, sort of policy wisdom of bailing out the failing automobile industry, which the Obama administration takes credit for, and which candidate Mitt Romney has been making a point of criticizing quite explicitly. So what do you think?
Oh, that sounds like a great idea. I think Glenn is referencing the fact that Vance Freed of Oklahoma State University and I co-authored an article that is appearing in the current issue of National Review called The College Cartel, in which we make a variety of arguments regarding the high cost of higher education and things that we might do to tackle it. And in part, my interest in this subject was prompted by the wonderful work of Kevin Carey of Education Sector, who is someone who identifies as being on the center-left, yet whose focus in looking at competition and the lack of competition in the higher education sector, as he sees it, the lack of constructive competition, perhaps I should say, as a key driver of rising costs. So this is a subject that I'm certainly no expert on, but it's something that has been of great interest to me for some time. And we tried to make some headway, and we tried to offer a fairly open-minded, broad-minded perspective of the issue in the article, with certainly a kind of, our ideological sensibilities informing our analysis to some degree. But we tried to give a pretty broad picture of what's going on in the industry.
Okay, so why don't we start by outlining, as you see it, what the problem is with the present-day state of affairs, college costs going up and up and up and becoming increasingly unaffordable to many Americans, prompting, therefore, policy initiatives such as those that the Obama administration has put forth. What do you see is wrong with the status quo state of affairs?
Well, I think it's very valuable, as you just said, that we focus on the underlying cost of the service, because people often fixate on tuition. But in fact, one concern, and you certainly hear this from the higher education industry, is that the underlying costs are growing very quickly, very unsustainably. And I think you see a lot of parallels with health expenditures as well. When you compare the cost of higher education in the United States to other affluent market democracies, you see a real difference. It seems for whatever reason to be getting more expensive faster and growing off of a higher base than in other affluent countries. And this is particularly problematic given that the edge that we once had in the attainment of even secondary education, but of higher education, has really dulled. We're now pretty much in the middle of the pack. So when you look at our oldest cohorts in the United States, they are among the most highly educated in the world. When you look at our younger cohorts, they're pretty much in the middle of the pack among affluent market democracies. So I think that this cost growth is a huge problem. And then this raises the question of, well, what exactly is the source of this cost growth? Because as President Obama said in his State of the Union, look, we can keep subsidizing, But if those underlying costs keep growing faster and faster, clearly these subsidies aren't actually going to do us much good. We keep losing ground in terms of affordability and access, despite the fact that, you know, perhaps we're offering ever larger subsidies. So I think that that's a really key issue. Let's look at the underlying costs and how much of this is being devoted to the kind of purposes that we think of as, say, the social justice-oriented purposes that we think the taxpayer should subsidize, rather than ancillary purposes relating to the interests of the insiders, the incumbents, who can tend to control these institutions.
That would be me, Raihan. I mean, as a member of the faculty at an Ivy League institution, I can think I have to count myself as a higher education insider. So let's go ahead, since we're talking about my paycheck. Keep going.
I'm not sure about that, because I think that it's we have this very diverse ecology of educational providers. I think that's a good and worthwhile thing. And I think that some of these elite research universities, they have a variety of different funding streams. I think it's entirely likely that even if, the kind of reforms that Vance and I envisioned were to take place, I think that universities of that kind are going to continue having these funding streams, et cetera. What I'm concerned about primarily is when you're looking at the cost structure of the institutions that are designed to serve the students for whom this is a crucial avenue of upward mobility. And I think that, you know, that's part of why, you know, you have this arms race, this kind of positional arms race, in which many schools, which would perhaps be best served by focusing on teaching, they're also engaging in a kind of research mission rather than focusing on the teaching mission. And, you know, in some cases, the research mission, you know, obviously enriches the teaching mission, but I think that we don't have adequate specialization across higher education institutions. I think that that's one potential problem. So I wouldn't say that, I certainly don't intend to demonize, you know, any particular class of person. I do think, though, that the lack of transparency, because, for example, the research mission is extremely, extremely valuable. But the issue is, you know, perhaps we should fund that in a more coherent and transparent way rather than allow for some of the cross subsidies that we see given the current funding structures. There's a whole, you know, kind of range of kind of very kind of complex entangling issues. But I think that, you know, the core thing I want to get across is that we're going to continue to have a diversity of providers. If anything, I want to see greater diversity. And I think there's a dangerous institutional isomorphism that derives from the role of regional accreditation cartels, which are controlled by the incumbents, by the accredited schools, that kind of force a lot of schools into this kind of narrow box. I think that that's a huge problem that I would definitely want to target.
Okay. Let's try to take this one piece at a time. So what do you think is driving the rapid increase in the cost of higher education and the relatively higher cost of higher education in the United States as compared to comparable societies elsewhere? What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think part of it is lack of entry. As we evoke in this idea of a college cartel, also as, you know, Kevin Carey has argued that, look, let's find ways to charter new instructional providers outside of that regional accreditation process, including low-cost instructional providers that are not colleges, but instructional providers that, for example, focus on teaching freshman-level calculus or some other thing so they can specialize in offering that service. So that's one thing that I think would lead to an improvement. Another thing is that when you see a lot of research universities, and I don't want to be sloppy here, but I think that you see a lot of a lack of spending discipline, in part because there's not a great deal of transparency regarding what counts as, for example, an instructional appropriation and what counts as administrative overhead. And when you see this this rise of, you know, what some suggest is administrative bloat, is that due to this lack of accountability?
Raihan, I'm sorry.
Oh, please.
Our audio is a little uneven. I need to ask you to repeat the...
Yes, I agree with that. And I wonder if perhaps we should try some other...
I was just saying that our audio is a little uneven, and I wanted you to repeat the last couple of sentences that you just said.
I was just talking about some different strategies for mitigating the power of the higher education cartel, including chartering new instructional providers. And then I was talking about some of the problems that might arise because of lack of transparency within the university itself regarding what counts as an administrative expenditure. So I think that that's a huge wedge, kind of things that are designed to support the instructional.
I got it. So wait a minute. Now, These issues of lack of transparency, I mean, you phrase it like that, but whenever there's joint production, I mean, whenever a productive enterprise is, through the efforts of its employees, producing more than one kind of output simultaneously, there's always this difficulty of apportioning the joint cost amongst the different products that are being jointly produced. There's a deep accounting problem here. Say, take a university which is producing, let's say, for simplicity's sake, two kinds of outputs, research of the faculty and instruction of the student body. So the faculty salary, the cost of maintaining the buildings and grounds, and many other factors that will go into producing both of these outputs at the same time. How do I know what portion of a faculty's salary, for example, to accredit to, you know, chalk up to the cost of instruction, and what portion to chalk up to the cost of research when these things are kind of happening simultaneously? Seems to me there's no obvious objective answer to that accounting puzzle.
Oh, I think that that's a very important. I think that that's a very important point, and I think that
okay. So that was one kind of point I wanted to make. Are you hearing me well enough?
You have certain institutions, for example, if you're a management consulting firm, or you know, kind of, let's say you're a physician who's working on diagnosing a given problem, you know, that tends to be something that is, as Clay Christensen has observed, that tends to be fee for service. And then when you're looking at executing on a particular mission, so you know, manufacturing a given good, something along those lines, then you're in this different domain. Where, you know, sort of, you know, say precision medicine, something along those lines, where we know how to solve the problem, we have a fairly straightforward way of solving the problem. So then the question is, with regard to higher education, can you meaningfully separate out those functions? And I think that there is some promising work on this front. So, for example, we talk about Western Governors University in our article, which is an institution that has really focused on the credentialing piece of higher education, where they say that, you know, one of the things that a college degree does is certify that you know certain things, that you have a certain skill set. And so their innovation was that, well, let's reverse engineer. Let's determine what are the things that we want you to know. And then we basically allow you to sort of to gain those skills in any number of ways. You might have gained them on the job, et cetera. So we think that that's an example of the kind of service where, you know, you could have a wider range of specialized focused providers where it's like, look, all I know how to do is teach you Korean. That's what I know how to do. That's what I'm going to focus on. And, you know, we have certain metrics. We do this using these particular tools. That's what we do. And we deliver value in that narrow domain. But you're absolutely right that there are some other disciplines and domains where, you know, kind of there this kind of co-production gets a lot more complicated. But I think that in terms of skill building, which strikes me as, you know, kind of one of the reasons why we subsidize higher education, it seems that we can make some improvement along at least that narrow front. And I think that doing that would have, you know, ancillary benefits.
So take Western Governors as an example. It seems to me that they're in the business basically of certifying that people who will have their credential know a certain set of things. And they're prepared to hand over that credential of certification to a person based on their performance on an exam, let's say, independently of how many hours that person spends actually studying under the faculty of Western Governors University. What they're selling is the service of certification that the student bearing this credential indeed does know what it is that that student says they know. Am I following you on that?
I'm afraid so yes, they're selling the service they're selling the credential.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to be sure that I caught that. And I think that that's I tend to think that as a good model. But no, what it leaves open is the question of, well, then how do you help people gain those skills? And I guess, you know, the attitude that we take is that, or at least that I take, is that, you know, we can't really anticipate. There could be all kinds of innovation in that space in terms of meeting the needs of teaching different disciplines. You know, and one problem with higher education right now is because of the to put it polemically, the accreditation cartel, we have this very narrow attitude regarding, well, how does one teach accounting? And I think that moving away from that and allowing for more experimentation and more trial and error in this space could lead to all kinds of different and potentially low-cost strategies for teaching those skills.
Oh, okay. Let's back up a little bit. So you say accreditation cartel, and you talk about the college cartel. And the word cartel is not neutral. It suggests in effect, conspiracy against the public interest, a restraint of trade, a limitation of the competition on behalf of those who happen already to be on the inside. Is that what you think motivates the accreditation process? You can't offer a degree in this field unless the local or regional accrediting organization is prepared to certify that your institution is up to standard. You think it's about restricting competition?
Well, I actually do think it's about restricting competition, although I think it's framed somewhat differently. So the idea is that, well, there's this, we'd otherwise have this anarchy of low-quality institutions,
right,
et cetera.
Right.
And so we must protect against that anarchy by, you know, kind of amongst ourselves deciding what counts as adequate instruction, et cetera.
Right.
And I think that the fundamental goal there, the underlying goal there, is a very admirable one. You want to protect students against hucksters, for example. But I tend to think that there are better ways to protect students against hucksters than the accreditation cartels, because the problem is that there's not really a ton of accountability when insiders are governing themselves. So it's the same case as, you know, why we would want more aggressive corporate boards, for example, or why we'd want, you know, any kinds of oversight by people who are not necessarily and the reason why we're concerned about things like regulatory capture. I think that that's really what motivates it. The stated, which I think are sincere, objectives of these accreditation bodies are totally admirable. We want to protect people, you know, from low quality providers. But I just don't think they're likely to go about it in the right way, because they're systematically biased towards traditional modes of instruction.
I see. Okay, now what about this idea that students learn from each other as well as from the college program itself, and that some of what goes on when you have more elite schools to which many students compete in order to be admitted is the creation of these local communities of very bright young people who have self-selected into the prestigious college and whose experience over the course of the 4 years of college education is enhanced not only by the quality of instruction that may be offered in the classroom, but also by the personal growth that they experience and the lifelong relationships that they form with other young people, again, self-selected based on a rigorous competition of academic standards to get admitted into the institution in the first place. And that's going to create, you know, kind of local monopoly. I mean, there's only going to be a few Harvards, Princetons, Stanfords, and so on, based on the logic of what I'm saying now, which is we're the top 1% of the top 1% of the aspiring 18 to 22-year-old young people seeking an education. 2,000 of them are gathered here on our campus, and that's what makes it worth paying $50,000 a year in order to get an education here.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I actually think of, you know, my interest in higher education, somewhat idiosyncratically, has very little to do with elite private research universities, though I had the pleasure of and the privilege of attending.
It shows, Raihan. It shows.
It's interesting you say that, because I think it does show in the sense that I was able to be a part of a lot of networks that I wouldn't otherwise have had access to, and I do think that is very, very valuable. But I think that the problem, as I see it, is that, look, there are many people, the large majority of students are not attending universities of that kind, elite residential universities. A lot of them are attending commuter schools. A lot of them are also, my concern is with increasing the quality and also the cost effectiveness of the schools that most students are attending. And I think that, you know, when you look at Generation Y, more than half of this generation is not going to have a four-year college degree. And I think that, you know, the question is, if we can actually make a high-quality education more accessible and affordable, I don't think that it precludes the continued existence of these other institutions. And I think that it's actually a perfectly reasonable question to ask, well, how can we make those institutions more inclusive, et cetera? But I guess what I care about, and one thing that I find interesting, is this idea that wouldn't it be great if actually the prestige were in institutions like Udacity, this institution established by an erstwhile Stanford professor, Sebastian Thrun, which is designed to be accessible to a much larger number of people than Stanford could ever practicably be accessible to. Something about these qualities, this solidarity, this cohesion, and this sort of cultivation of cultural capital that you describe can't really scale up. But there are certain other things that can scale up. So, for example, the kind of things that Western Governors does, what MITx does, that really can scale quite well. And I think that that's what I, you know, kind of on public policy grounds think is the really urgent and important issue, though of course I do care partly on sentimental grounds, that these elite private research universities really are doing a better job of fulfilling what they see as their mission, et cetera. But I just don't see that as a really core issue. And that also relates to my thinking about issues like preferences for people from underrepresented backgrounds, for example. I tend to think of that as much less central than a lot of other people. I tend to be much less hostile, to those measures, in part because I just think of that as a somewhat narrower issue than a lot of these other issues that I care about that I think are more directly concerned to the kind of egalitarian concerns that I have.
Let me see if I followed that last. Though you are conservative, I mean no offense in that, you're not as hostile to affirmative action as some people might be because you think that the fundamental equity issues in higher education are much more elemental and have to do with the kind of things that you've been talking about, limitations on entry and a kind of hidebound attitude amongst people about what constitutes a good college experience.
Yeah, I mean, very few students are attending selective colleges and universities.
Right.
And so I think that, I might disagree with other, I wouldn't say that I like preferences,
right.
But I do think that, leaving those decisions to the institutions themselves, and provided that there's, and I'd want to see transparency, et cetera, but leaving those decisions to the institutions themselves seems like a more sensible strategy. But the thing is that when I think about upward mobility and what I want higher education to achieve, it seems to me as though preferences are a pretty marginal issue.
Okay. Now, you and your co-author make the argument that reducing or eliminating federal support for higher education might actually have the effect of expanding access to college for most people. That's counterintuitive, at least to my ear. Can you explain how you see that working?
Well, I guess the idea is right now the way it works, you have subsidies at the state level. And you also have federal subsidies. And one thing that you've seen happen in many states is you see them reduce some of their support for their public universities. Yet the federal government then steps in to increase Pell Grants, to increase other forms of aid, et cetera. And also the state governments will say, well, you can now increase your tuition. So then you have this very kind of weird dynamic in which you have this kind of defunding at one level, and then you have – and yet – while the state governments might have exerted some cost control, the federal government actually hasn't exerted that kind of cost control, partly for the reason that I think people are very wary of the federal government mucking up, these local policies, residual kind of federalist impulse. And so then you actually have this lack of accountability in the system. So for the same reasons that, for example, I tend to think that it would be good to nationalize the Medicaid program, I think that, focusing accountability to some degree, that would gain, that would give you some benefit. And the other thing is that if you don't have adequate competition, what happens in the case of any cartel when you increase subsidies? You're just going to see more extraction on the part of the insiders, whether or not they think of themselves self-consciously as engaging in this kind of nefarious extraction. So that's the basic argument.
Okay, I see.
I should say that we do support federal loan programs, but we just think that, operating them on a different basis would be sensible. Oh, I'm sorry, Glenn, what was that part?
No, that's okay. Let's just keep going. What would you think about the idea of having the state's subsidies to state universities be made directly available to the state residents? It's the idea here, if you're a resident of Wisconsin or California or Illinois and you attend the University of Wisconsin or the University of California, Berkeley, or the University of Illinois, what you pay is less than the cost of your education. You get an implicit subsidy because the in-state residents are paying less than what someone would pay if they came from out of state. What about the idea of giving those subsidies in a voucher-like fashion to state residents and then leaving them be free to spend those subsidies anywhere, not only at the state university? Would this not be a move in the direction that you guys are in favor of?
I think that's an excellent idea. And I also think that, one potential issue is that there are a lot of subsidies that are embedded in taxpayer funding of the various schools. So Vance is championing this idea of creating public charter colleges in which you allow certain private colleges to agree that they're going to charge a tuition, that is the same as that of the most expensive, state college or less, and yet have autonomy in terms of how they offer those services, et cetera. So that's one strategy. I mean, I think the anxiety would be that, you know, I imagine that there are some state politicians who would be concerned about state residents using those resources and transferring them to other states. And the idea that, well, then we're not capturing the benefit of that. I don't think that that's, and then they might say, well, if we subsidize you in this way, we expect you to live in the state. Of course, you know, you can make people do that. So I think that, you know, there would be some resistance from state politicians, but I certainly find that idea very attractive and also very sensitive.
Okay, another question I have is, which is about cartels, but it's not accreditation cartels keeping new universities from getting accredited and thereby competing with the incumbents, but it's financial aid cartels where, in effect, the universities are not competing as vigorously as they might to reduce tuition for those students who are the most attractive potential admittees. That is to say, if someone gets a very high SAT score, looks like they would be a great person to have at your college, why not have
the college? I'm sorry,
Yeah.
So you're talking about institutional aid to attract the most, the students who raise test scores, et cetera, that kind of thing, rather than to focus on sort of the kind of students who perhaps are most most in need of the additional funding? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, I'm raising this question about competition, but I'm now looking at competition for students by the colleges, not through lowering the price for everybody, but through a kind of price discrimination scheme where they would compete for students by, in effect, charging lower tuition for the students whom they thought would be more desirable to attract to their institutions, which goes against the sensibility of kind of need-blind admission.
I think that that's definitely something that, that merits more attention. And I guess, the way that I think about this is that certainly happens, and I want that to be subjected to more scrutiny. I'm not sure if that's the kind of thing I would be keen to regulate, except insofar as it relates to whether or not taxpayers are getting an adequate return. In my ideal world, I would want to see these kind of elite private universities that sort of tend to be the schools that compete in, along these dimensions. I would want them to want to see them relying more on their own resources, and I'd want to see focusing sort of the resources on the students who need the resources.
Okay. I want to suggest that we move on to the other topic that we were going to discuss in this conversation, which is fascinating to me, in which I've heard you not long ago speaking about. I saw you on Bill Maher maybe 3 weeks ago arguing with people about the Detroit bailout, and you took the position that it was a mistake for the government, the Obama administration, to go in with these huge subsidies for the auto companies in Detroit. And this in the face of, a great deal of hostile pushback where people were saying, in effect, well, what would have happened is the industry would have been collapsed. It would have been a disaster. There would have been such unemployment. The supply chains would have been disrupted, and so on. So, what is the case, the libertarian case or the conservative case, against what you're calling crony capitalism? Why do you think that it would have been wiser for the government to have avoided the subsidies implicit in bailing out the auto companies? And, what's the story there?
Well, I guess the way that I think about it is, do you see the economy and these kinds of decision-making processes as a finite game or as an infinite game? And I think that a lot of the folks who look at the bailouts, they say, well, look, it was successful. And I think they're essentially seeing it as a finite game. There was a disaster. We go in, we intervene, and then we save the companies, and then, and all is well with the world. Whereas I think another view is that, well, it's not a finite game. It's, in fact, an infinite game, because at some point in the future, there will be other firms that might be characterized as strategic, or rather that politicians might consider particularly salient for all kinds of reasons, perhaps because the people in the industry are voters, they're well-situated in a swing state or whatever else. And then when you say that, as in the case of Chrysler, you know, because Chrysler wasn't able to get financing through conventional channels, they had to issue secured debt. And then, you know, that secured debt was not treated as those investors had anticipated. And then they were not given any deficiency claims, which was very, very unorthodox. So the thing is, you could say, oh, well, fair enough. You know, we're pragmatic and we move along and that's just fine. But again, what happens the next right. time investors are asked to invest in a firm that could colorably be described as politically strategic in some way? Then it's possible that they will not be able to raise that round of financing. And then the government will have to intervene even sooner. And so I think that that's my anxiety. It's kind of what happens next. And, you know, I obviously have other concerns about what exactly happened, you know, kind of within that process, within the managed bankruptcy process. And I'd say that, you know, I certainly believe that there should have been a managed bankruptcy. I even think that it's reasonable to say that perhaps TARP funds could have been used for debtor in possession financing or something like that. But I think that, you know, that's what I really care about. You know, kind of what signals are you sending to future investors?
Yeah, but what people are saying is that without the intervention, those firms would have gone down. I've heard Steve Rattner say this many times. I read him on the pages of the New York Times saying this, that at the time, private money was had no interest whatsoever in coming in to be a part of a structured, you know, sort of salvation of these companies that were near bankruptcy. They would have gone bankrupt. And had they gone bankrupt, all of these established relationships with their secondary companies that are supplying them would have been broken. And the ripple effect of, you know, unemployment and reduced demand and recession or depression would have just spread out. So once the company is bankrupt and it's dismembered and its pieces are sold off and its existing relationships with suppliers are broken, that's something that can't be put back together again. So what's wrong with that argument, that the disruption costs would have been so great that even though these interventions might not have been ideal, they nevertheless were necessary because there was no private money to be had?
Well, I think that, you know, it's fundamentally challenging that premise. I think that, you know, kind of one argument that one often hears, which I think is correct, is that, you know, there's a difference between firms that are merely financially distressed and that have economically failed. And I think that we're in the domain of the counterfactual. It's very hard to say exactly what might have happened under different circumstances. But the, you know, my sense is that had you not had this particular kind of intervention, we might have had an intervention, but it might have proceeded along somewhat different lines. So I think that, you know, bankruptcy, you know, these firms could have started preparing for bankruptcy earlier on in 2008, but they sense that they would be able to extract more from the taxpayer were they to leave themselves in a more perilous position. So I think that actually those are legitimate concerns. But the thing is that the very value of those large provider networks, et cetera, is precisely why my impression is that GM would very likely have survived. And in the case of Chrysler, you know, perhaps Chrysler would have been liquidated. Perhaps something else would have, you know, perhaps we would see that firm dissipate. But the thing is that even within the Obama administration, you had people like Austin Goolsbee saying that, well, perhaps to preserve the viability of GM, we should let Chrysler go under. I mean, those are kind of legitimate questions. So I think that it really is not a case of should we have had a managed bankruptcy or not? Should the federal government have provided bridge financing if other debtor in possession financing hadn't been available? Rather, it's these questions about the way the bankruptcy process was really manipulated and changed in ways that I think a lot of investors consider problematic.
Yeah. But politically, it's hard to envision governments not responding in this way, even if I grant everything that you've said about the, in principle, desirability of avoiding the moral hazard problems, of avoiding the, you know, companies changing their business strategies in anticipation of their ability to use political influence in order to bail themselves out, distorting of investment decisions because investors have to worry about whether or not you know, promises to repay them are going to be kept in the event of some, you know, some political intervention. Even if I grant all of that, it's hard to see as a practical political matter how any, it's hard to see how Mitt Romney wins this argument, for example. It's just hard for me to see how,
a
practical matter, he wins it. So there's a Samaritan's dilemma here. This is what I'm trying to get to. The Samaritan's dilemma is someone goes up into the mountains. You tell them before they go, be very careful and don't go too high and take all that you need because something could happen and then you get trapped up there and I'm not going to come and save you.
thinking that that'll force them to do the right thing. Of course, they know that if they get up there and they get trapped and they're about to freeze to death, as a matter of fact, you are going to go and save them. There's no way that you, the Samaritan, can commit to not helping the person when they're in dire need. And so the whole situation sort of falls apart. I mean, you can talk tough, but when the proverbial SHIT hits the fan, you're not going to act tough. What about that as a political reality?
I think that you're absolutely right. Not only do I think you're right, but I think that when you look at the broader consumer credit market, when you look at, for example, the fact that government is now guaranteeing 60% of all mortgage-related debt and virtually all new mortgage-related debt, you basically have the situation in which so-called private commercial banks are actually not determining their underwriting standards, and the government is bearing 100% of the credit risk on loan defaults. So then what exactly is the private sector doing in that case? And if the government is playing that big a role in the consumer credit market, well, when people are in distress, when, for example, student loan debtors are in distress, then suddenly, it's a political matter. How do you treat student loan debtors who are in distress, et cetera? You don't have this, those are not decisions that are being made voluntarily in civil society, in these voluntary economic transactions. Rather, because they're so backstopped by the state, I think that not only are you right to raise that concern, that consideration, but I think that it's actually only getting worse and worse. I actually think that, the idea that the United States is particularly laissez-faire, particularly small government, I think is absolutely wrong and less true. It just happens that the way that we deploy government is through, off-balance sheet credit guarantees. It is through tax expenditures. It's in the least visible ways possible that has given rise to all kinds of terrible pathologies. And I think that actually, in some respects, having a larger transparent state would be preferable. And I say this as someone who, is very much an advocate of a small state. But I think that this is something that I think is a real anxiety that it's not
state,
clear to me that many of our leaders understand. That actually, we have a pseudo small state in the United States, and the shadow state is getting bigger and bigger, and it's not just tax expenditures, it is credit guarantees. And I think that, it sort of makes it impossible to say no in these situations.
Yeah.
That's not a very happy note.
So, Rahan, I have a question for you.
I mean, that's part of why
Are you supporting Ron Paul in this campaign season?
No, I'm not. Not only am I not supporting Ron Paul, but I mean, I think that, weirdly, I think that I've become, I don't want to say more partisan, but it's hard to explain, but I think that when I look at this landscape, it makes me think that the 2012 election is indeed a very important one. It's a cliche about conservatives that we think of 2012 as a make or break election. And I really do believe that, partly because I just think of Ron Paul as being outside of the range of people who could make a kind of reasonable difference. And I also think that his mental models regarding how the economy works are just not sound. But I do think that someone like Mitt Romney is willing to make the thankless case against, the particular, he's like, well, I'm for a managed bankruptcy. I'm just not for that kind of managed bankruptcy, which is ridiculous on the campaign trail. It's just not a very effective argument as you highlight.
Right.
But I think that it just strikes me as very sensible. And
so it's very sad to see not make
this case as effective. And that's certainly a legitimate anxiety. That happens to be one of the areas where I think that he has unshakable convictions. The areas where Mitt Romney has unshakable convictions happen to be the policy domains that I care the most about. And the areas where he doesn't have unshakable convictions are domains where I really think there's a lot of room for disagreement. So I might be the only person in the country who is well aligned with him in those regards.
Okay. I think the next time we talk, and I hope there will be a next time, you should grill me on why it is that I'm not supporting Mitt Romney in the upcoming contest.